I called it To Honor and to be Honored. Our culture is one that enshrines the dishonorable. In the place of statesmen, we honor stooges and scoundrels. In the place of religious and philosophical truth, moral goodness, and genuine artistic beauty, we exalt overpaid athletes, morally bankrupt Hollywood celebrities, and the crony capitalist Randians currently allying Silicon Valley with the PC police. Of course, there are exceptions from time to time, as when some authentic virtue is praised, a genuine artist recognized, or some tribute is made to a noble institution. But these are exceptions to the norm, and they are becoming fewer and farther between. Now, I'm going to add a little footnote here, because I mentioned Randians currently allying Silicon Valley with the PC police. Well, the Randians, of course, would be the disciples of Ayn Rand. And if you don't know who Ayn Rand is, she lived from 1905 to 1982. She was a Russian emigre to the United States of America. She was a so-called philosopher. She claimed to have gotten her insights from reading Aristotle, and she created the philosophical school called Objectivism, which is something that's liked in certain libertarian circles, certain quote-unquote anarcho-capitalist circles. But Ayn Rand was an absolutely morally bankrupt individual. Her philosophy is disgusting. It's an enshrining of human selfishness. And she was kind of a reactionary against communism. But remember, the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. That's not the way it works. You know, just because we have a common enemy doesn't mean we agree. So she was nuts. She wrote two famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. I almost said Brideshead Revisited. The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Those were her two big contributions. You know, when a philosopher has to resort to expressing her philosophy in novels, you know there's no real philosophy there. This is what Sartre did. This is what a lot of the existentialists did. There's no systematic philosophy there, so they have to express it sort of sentimentally and with emotional appeal in novels and plays and things like that. I'm not against novels. I'm not against plays. But when that's the principal expression of a so-called philosopher, there's no real philosophy there. Certainly nothing systematic. And yes, she was a disgusting human being. She was an adulteress. She was gross. Moving right along, partly to blame is democracy, a system which is supposed to ennoble the common man, often along the false lines of egalitarianism, but which inevitably, as Christophe Buffon de Chassal informs us, ends up enshrining the most ignoble of oligarchs who enslave the populace to their agenda. That's exactly what our democracy is right now, right? I mean, in such a system, gone are all the traditions, not only of monarchy, but also of aristocracy and of social hierarchy in general. Even the much vaunted republican virtue cannot survive democracy. What replaces all this is a triumvirate of big government, big business, big media that tears down traditions of decency, robs the populace of their genuine self-determination and independence, and keeps the masses doped up on some somnolent opiate or another so that they fail to notice that they are being denatured. By the way, I wrote this almost 2 years ago. This was pre-COVID when I wrote this. Now, I'm not saying I was a prophet. I certainly wasn't. I was writing about very current events and past events that were informing this. But notice that the COVID thing only accelerated this. I talk about the triumvirate of big government, big business, and big media. That's exactly what we see in the COVID phenomena. Big government, big business, big media, big tech, you could say. But big tech is part of big media. It's also part of big business. There's that nexus there. But if you look at what's going on with the COVID thing, it's those guys that I pointed to here as the ones who are robbing us of our genuine self-determination and independence and being doped up and kept somnolent by these opiates that they offer to us. All right, democracy cannot be all to blame for sure. A succession of revolutions from the Protestant to the French Masonic and to the industrial and to the sexual, all these revolutions, Protestant Revolution, French Revolution, Industrial Revolution, Sexual Revolution, have led to our present sad state. But instead of wringing our hands over it, let us do the more difficult thing by learning what honor is and practicing it in our homes and in our communities. Again, so I'm stepping out of my article here. Again, we're going to have that Congress in a little over a week. And at that Congress, we're going to discuss how to form a new Christendom. Let's take seriously the subject of honor so that we can practice it in our homes and in our communities, because we're not capable of building something from the top down. We're not actually starting a new country. We don't have that power. We can put together the building blocks from which a new Christendom can be built later in God's time, right? But the building blocks need to be there. And what are the building blocks? Okay, well, each of us is individuals, but we are not atomized. And yeah, the COVID thing has definitely helped to atomize us further. Modernity has the tendency to atomize humans. The COVID thing accelerated that atomization so much that people are committing suicide because they're deprived of a normal social life. Children are being psychologically scarred and emotionally scarred, and many people now are coming out of the woodworks saying this. So what we need to do is strengthen our sense of community, strengthen the social bonds, and realize that the bad guys can't win if we have the social bonds, the social structures that protect the individual from them, right? That's what these so-called intermediate bodies do in a society. Guilds, church groups, religious orders, social clubs of all sorts. These intermediate bodies, these intermediate organizations, institutions that stand between the naked power of the state and the individual are extremely important. Even, by the way, in a society where, as with the guilds, they sort of integrated themselves into the state somewhat by giving those individuals represented by the guild a voice in the state. That's how it was in certain medieval societies. What we're saying is that these intermediate societies form a buffer between the raw power of bigness, big business, big state, big media, and the individual. And if we don't have those intermediate things, beginning with the family and then moving up to the next level of, say, parish, neighborhood. I mean, we're talking low level here, right? Little clubs, little gatherings where you have social networks of like-minded Catholics who have your values, share your standards, and who can help strengthen each other. No, we won't get the jab. No, this is how you avoid that. No, this is how you tell people, I don't wear a mask when I go out in public. This is how you do that. You know, when you can strengthen each other like that, that has great value, where there is literally strength in numbers. Okay, there very much is. That's true. It might be a bit of an overused statement, a little platitude, but there really is strength in numbers. And it's not just the numbers, though. It's the tightness. It's the integration. It's the cohesiveness. It's the shared standards. So one of those standards, of course, being honor. According to the Catholic Encyclopedia, quote, honor may be defined as a deferential recognition by word or sign of another's worth or station. Thus, I show honor to another by giving him his title, if he have one, and by raising my hat to him or yielding to him a place of precedence. I thereby give expression to my sense of his worth, and at the same time, I profess my own inferiority to him, end quote. You may notice I frequently interview people who have doctorates. Well, I'm one of those guys who insist on calling people with PhDs doctor. simply because, you know, they spent that much time getting a PhD, they deserve the title doctor. I don't, you know, that's not the only reason I do it. I do have this idea that you give honor to whom honor is due. If I find out that somebody's in the military and he was a captain, I'll address him by his rank. A lot of times people tell me, yeah, don't do that. And at that point, I don't. But the idea is you show some differential respect to people who do have these legitimate titles. Of course, you call a priest father, or if he's a Monsignor, Monsignor. You call bishops Your Excellency. You don't say bishop. That's not a spoken title. And you use all of the proper honorifics and so forth when you're addressing these people, either in writing or in speech. This is part of giving honor to whom honor is due. Now, you might say, well, suppose the person's a rat. You know, suppose he's a moral reprobate. Well, that's going to be addressed in a little bit. So hold that aside. St. Thomas treats honor in two places in the Summa Theologiae. Both are in the Secunda Secundae, where he treats of the virtues of justice and fortitude, respectively, with all their parts. Now, St. Thomas talks about parts of the virtues. So he treats about 50 moral virtues, 550 moral virtues. And those which aren't one of the four cardinal virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude, generally are assigned to those four as parts of them. They might be a quasi-part, or it's complicated the way that St. Thomas actually sort of gives the taxonomy of these things, but we don't have to go there. Let's just say that those are the four major headings. They're the cardinal virtues. They're hinges upon which hangs the entire door of all of the virtues. So he treats of the virtues of justice and fortitude respectively with all their parts. He reckons the virtue of dulia, whereby we pay honor to other things pertaining to those who are in a higher position. Excuse me. Whereby we pay honor and other things pertaining to those who are in a higher position as a part of the virtue of observance, which in turn is a special virtue that is part of the cardinal virtue of justice. Later, while considering the virtue of fortitude and its parts, he writes of the virtue of magnanimity, which is, quote, about great honors, and which by which one is, quote, minded to do some great act. We're going to see the connection between magnanimity and greatness in a little bit. By dulia, we honor those who deserve it. By magnanimity, we act in such a way as to merit honor. In simpler terms, as a matter of justice, each of us has the duty of honoring those who are worthy of it, whether they merit honor because their personal virtue or because of their personal virtue or their station in life. As a matter of fortitude, each one of us ought to aspire to do those great and virtuous things which are themselves honorable. At this point, I can hear an objection forming in people's minds. But we're supposed to be humble, not aspire to honors, right? In part, yes. It is true that St. Teresa of Avila has much to say in her writings about those who are preoccupied with honor. The honor of their family, of their name, of their person, etc. What she is inveighing against, and it is a vice more common in her age, which was much more honorable than our own, is clearly something based on the vice of pride, and is therefore a serious obstacle to sanctity. But she would certainly not contradict St. Thomas's observation that while one ought not to be attached to the honor shown him by others, he still ought to be honorable. Quote from St. Thomas, "If, however, one were to despise honors so as not to care to do what is worthy of honor, this would be deserving of blame. Accordingly, magnanimity is about honors in the sense that a man strives to do what is deserving of honor, yet not so as to think much about the honor accorded by man." End quote. So I think that's pretty wise. So he's, you know, obviously humility is the check against this false inflation or elation of mind, a higher estimation of oneself than one ought to have, right? Which is pride, being puffed up.